Good afternoon, everybody. I am pleased to welcome Senator Joni Kearns to Greene County as part of her 99-county tour. She was born and raised in Montgomery County, Iowa. In November of 2014, Senator Kearns was elected as the first woman to serve in federal elected office in the state of Iowa, and also became the first female combat veteran elected to serve in the United States Senate. She is a retired Lieutenant Colonel in the Iowa National Guard. In Washington, Senator Kearns serves on five committees of major importance to Iowans: Armed Services, Agriculture, Nutrition and Forestry, Environment and Public Works, Small Business and Entrepreneurship, and Judiciary. And I'm going to deviate from the script just one second, if you will indulge me. I also had the pleasure of serving side by side with Senator Kearns when she was in the Iowa Senate. And I had the pleasure to serve with her for 4 years down there, and I will tell you, she is a fantastic individual, and I really enjoyed working with her. So it's my honor to introduce Senator Joni Kearns.
Okay, and we are going to have your representative go ahead and lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance. Thank you, Phil, and thank you, Jerry, so much for the introduction.
States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Well, welcome, everybody. It's great to be out in Greene County today. This is stop number 13 on my 99-county tour, so just enjoying the day. It's been a beautiful day to be out and about, and the way we run our meetings, of course, is I'm not going to start with any opening comments because I'm sure we'll get to everything with the questions. We want to get to as many questions as possible, so hopefully you have filled out a card if you want to ask a question. If you didn't, go ahead and raise your hand if you want to ask a question, and the staff will get a card to you, and we'll throw it in the box. Marvin will go ahead and draw names out of the box so everybody has an equal opportunity to ask a question, and we're just going to go ahead and get started. So, Marvin, if you would.
Okay. The first person will be Taylor McKee, and the second, the next one that will follow, will be Elvin Thompson.
Okay.
Elvin Thompson will be the second person.
Okay, Taylor, yes, go ahead, stand up, please.
So my question was, you have come out saying that you don't agree with Donald Trump's trans bans within the military. As a military service member, what do you plan on doing to support those members?
Yes, still working with those members. And we do hear from a lot of different individuals that want to serve our country. And I think that that is very important. I don't care. I think as long as you are meeting the physical requirements to enter into the military and you want to lay down your life for this country, you believe in our country, I will gladly have anyone that is willing to do that serve beside me. So continuing to work with the administration and just broadening their views and making sure that that standards are equally applied across the board and that we're not selectively choosing certain individuals to participate or not participate. So I do think that's important. And there are a number of us that are veterans in Congress that have come forward to state that as well. I think it's important. If you love your country and you're able to serve, you should be able to do so freely. So thank you very much.
In the newspaper that Iowa depends upon the other day, I read that the state of Utah flies their employees to San Diego, whereupon they can cross the border to obtain their prescription drugs. And it's cheaper for the state of Utah, which I think is a red state, it's cheaper for them to do that rather than pay the local prices. For a policy like that, there's a word, let me choose it carefully. That's crazy. I don't expect a complete answer. I mean, it's a very complicated problem, but there has to be a better solution for us than that.
Yeah, there is a better solution, guaranteed. And this is one of the biggest bipartisan issues that we see going through Congress today, which is addressing the cost of prescription drugs. It is such an issue out there, and one of the great examples that we've seen in recent years is insulin, the cost of insulin, not just for type 1 diabetics like my brother and sister that have been insulin dependent their entire lives, but also those type 2 diabetics that are reliant upon that product too. Largely, we know insulin has not changed in the past century, much at all. It's been around that long. But what the drug companies will do, and something that we're trying to combat through legislation, is the changing of patents on drugs that exist out there. So there's a number of different proposals. I'll address a few of those that I've been working on. I am signed on to 9 different prescription drug bills. We have one, the CREATES Act, that has actually passed. It was bipartisan and signed into law. So that was a really good one, but we have a lot more yet to do. So addressing it from the Judiciary Committee, which is a committee that I am on, one of the issues that we were looking at is the fact that drug companies, when they have a drug that they've introduced into the marketplace, they will put a patent on that drug, and maybe that patent expires in 10 years. As they get close to the end of that patent registration, they will change their formulary just a little bit, enough that they can slap a new patent on it and prevent generics from being developed and introduced into the market to drive down the cost. So we're combating that, what we call patent layering issue. We're addressing that through legislation. There are also big pharma companies that will actually pay off competitors so they don't develop generics. And so we're working on that issue too. I mean, we've discovered so many issues with the pharmaceutical costs here in the United States. We're all trying to address that through legislation. Senator Grassley has a proposal with Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, another bipartisan bill. I know, you raise your eyebrows. I know we have odd friendships sometimes in the Senate. And so those two working together have put together a plan that is, it is supported largely with the intent that it would bring down prescription drugs. I see my friends from AARP here. What it would do is cap the out-of-pocket costs for our seniors and close up some of the loopholes that exist in Medicare. And so that's another proposal that I'm working with Senator Grassley on. Mike Crapo also has a prescription drug bill that does a lot of the similar things as the Wyden-Grassley proposal. I'm on that one as well. We also deal with the pharmacy benefit managers. We have a middleman here in the United States that negotiates drug costs, and that's part of the issue that we see out there. There is no transparency in that system. So when they're negotiating between the local pharmacists and what they're delivering to their customers as they come in and what's being negotiated from those pharmaceutical companies, we have no idea how that's being negotiated. We have no idea who's getting the rebates. So there's a lot of issues in the system that we have here in the United States when it comes to pharmaceutical drugs. We're trying to tackle those issues, but we see the instances where other countries are able to offer our drug products at a much lower cost. And it's the American people that are taking the brunt of that burden in providing those types of pharmaceuticals for the rest of the world. So it's all of those issues we are sorting through and trying to find a way that we can push back on that, make sure that our citizens are the ones that are benefiting from the wonderful research and development that's done here in the United States, but also keeping those drug costs low for our consumers. So a lot of different proposals. Like I said, I'm on 9 different proposals right now, and we're hoping to get those moved through health, education, labor, and pension very shortly.
You know, the reason they're able to do that is because other countries have a single-payer system.
We can debate that later, but we've got other questions in the queue, you betcha.
Next person would be Don Corrigan.
Hi, Don.
The old jury,
Don and then Noah.
Just as a follow-up, with the Bradley-White bill that you just mentioned, what do you think of the odds of passing that are in the near future?
Okay, so we visit with Leader McConnell every Monday night, and this is an issue that I've brought up. Of course, Senator Grassley talks till he's blue in the face. And then we had Shelley Moore Capito as well. While she wasn't necessarily promoting one prescription drug bill over another, you know, she really, really got on this last Monday night in our leadership meeting because we all want to see something moving on prescription drugs. McConnell, in that conversation, indicated we would have a vote on it, but he didn't say which proposal, but he does understand how important this issue is for Americans and that we've got to get it right. So I anticipate we will have a vote on it. I just don't know when that's going to fall, but it would fall in this Congress.
Thank
you. Yeah, thank you.
Okay. No, Julie?
I want to thank you for your time and service. For me in particular, I'm not a veteran. But I am concerned about all the suicides that you hear with veterans coming home. It's my understanding you had something to do with like $25 million addition to a bill that got passed through Congress for suicide prevention and research. And I'm just curious how that seems like a lot of money to me. I was wondering how it's working and if you're going to continue that.
There are a lot of different initiatives that I've been involved in when it comes to veterans and suicide. And just as an aside, just suicide in general has been an issue I'm very concerned about. A lot of folks will focus on veterans, and because I'm a veteran, it is important to me. I've known individuals just here in Iowa that have taken their lives. So it is significant to me. Another population, which I worked with Tammy Baldwin on some legislation that got passed in the last farm bill, was addressing farmer suicide. And per capita, when you look at different careers, farmers actually have a higher incidence of suicide than veterans. So that's an issue that we are spending some time on as well, and that did get signed into law. A number of pieces of legislation that I've been involved with and actually are working. We are moving in the right direction with veteran suicide. Do we still have veteran suicide? Yes, but we're finally putting in place the measurements necessary to track injuries that might cause veterans to be susceptible to suicide. So I'll use an example of a gentleman that I had the opportunity to work with. He's a former Navy SEAL. His son also went into the SEALs. Now, the special operators and, of course, a lot of other veterans will have been exposed to various blasts through their careers. Maybe they've been in vehicle accidents where they suffer traumatic brain injury. Well, there is a connection between traumatic brain injury and suicidal ideations. You know, there's brain scarring that can't be detected by any sort of testing means out there. So most of the time, like in my friend's case, his son suffered a number of blasts, injuries to his head. And it was only after his son committed suicide, when they did an autopsy, I mean, they just thought he had, you know, and not my words, but they just thought, this SEAL, he's gone crazy. You know, we just can't deal with him anymore. And so he had been discharged. And then he tried to get help, but nobody would help him. He had no physical outward scarring. He couldn't get assistance. He took his life. And it was only post-mortem, when they did the autopsy, when they examined his brain, they found layers and layers of scar tissue on his brain. And they are starting to understand now, they being physicians and medical personnel, that has a lot to do with some of the veteran suicides that we're seeing. They're exposed to a lot of different things that maybe folks just every day, you know, here in Iowa are not. And so what they're starting to do, and one of the initiatives I've been involved in, is making sure that We're starting with our special operators. What we're doing is baselining them through a series of tests. So we know what their brain functions are now, and then we track them throughout their career. And especially if they've had a significant event like a blast, we're tracking that so that we know if they have been through those types of exposures, then we can work with behavioral health and other forms of support to make sure that we're giving them what they need so that they're not going through those suicide ideations and they have that support built in. But yes, working on a number of different initiatives. My latest is through the Department of Energy. It's a Department of Energy bill working with the Veterans Affairs. We're utilizing data and data technology to sort through veterans' records to identify those that maybe are susceptible to suicide and been exposed to some of these types of injuries. That will be included in the Department of Energy bill that we pass this next week. And the reason everybody be like, why Department of Energy? Because they have some of the greatest computing systems in the United States, located at Department of Energy. They have the ability to rapidly sort through hundreds of thousands of records and identify those veterans that might need additional assistance. So it's been fascinating to learn more and more about veteran suicide, but certainly making sure that even just the simplest thing right here at our VA centers, that we have the appropriate personnel to handle crises when they occur, that we have the funding available to do that. We've also found in our female veteran population, most of the time, especially if they've suffered from military sexual trauma, they are not as comfortable speaking to a male counselor. So making sure that we have female peer counselors that can step in assist them as well. So $25 million, it does sound like a lot of money. It is being well utilized across all of these different areas in the United States. I think we're making an impact, but we have to keep going. We have to keep going. We all long for the day when there's no veteran suicide. I'm sorry, could you say that a little louder? Yes, yes. Okay, so the question was the proposed cuts to the Corps of Engineers budgets. So yes, addressing that. And you will see that there are a number of areas of proposed cuts. You'll see Corps of Engineers, other departments. But what I would say to you is that the president has to propose a budget by law. He's required to submit a budget. Just always remember that it is Congress that will be in control of that budget. We know that there are a lot of projects that exist within the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers that have been authorized. They don't have enough funding right now to complete all of those projects. And that's what we had seen over in Cedar Rapids after the floods of 2008. For 10 years, they struggled to get funding. The project for their flood mitigation had been authorized through Congress, which we said, Corps, you're good to go. You can do this project. The problem was they didn't have the money to do it. So we had to circle back around and find the funds for Cedar Rapids. So it's on us to make sure that we are appropriately funding these projects that are really important to our communities across the United States. That's something that we will be working on. Now, out of Environment Public Works, which is where a lot of these projects are funded, we did pass out this last September a transportation and infrastructure bill. It is a plussed-up bill. So it will include additional dollars available to our states for various projects. That bill passed out of EPW unanimously, meaning all of our Democrats and all of our Republicans supported it. I supported it. I didn't agree with everything in the bill, but it was important to get done. I supported it. So we're hopeful that the House will agree with what we have decided in the Senate. We can get it moved off the floor of the Senate and off the floor of the House and then get it to the President for his signature. But we do have additional dollars coming for infrastructure. So while the President has to propose a budget, it's Congress that's going to take a look at that and make sure that we're providing for our constituencies. So thank you.
We have major corporations right now that are in foot race to put driverless vehicles on taxpayer funded and paid for roads. I think we should have savings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we are talking about that. And as a matter of fact, I visited and it was the University of Iowa. It's maybe been a couple years back, but they were working on an autonomous vehicle project over there. So there's various levels of autonomy that are being tested out there, and yes, we do have concerns. So the Department of Transportation is charged with kind of oversight and making sure that these autonomous vehicles are adhering to guidelines that will be set forward either through rule or by law by Congress. So I'm aware of what's going on out there. I still do have concerns. We've seen instances where people will fall asleep in their autonomous vehicle. They will strike pedestrians, they hit bicyclists. So yes, there are concerns with those vehicles out there. So there is not broad agreement across the spectrum on how we should move forward with this. I do think that there are situations where autonomous vehicles are important, and we can talk about farming uses where a grain cart can move from point A to point B in the field. Great, that's good. And logistical movements in war zones, so less of us truck drivers have to be on the road. That's important technology that we're looking into. I still have very mixed feelings, as you do, about how much we allow out on our roadways. So it is something that we are watching. But where we are on any laws right now, yeah, I couldn't tell you. I don't know of anybody that's proposed any legislation which would just outright allow them.
It could eliminate a lot of jobs that are good paying that we really don't have to eliminate. It wouldn't benefit that many people.
Right. If you're like talking about logistical industry with truck driving and so forth. And one thing with autonomous vehicles, there will always be a level of human interaction necessary. I believe necessary for that. There always needs to be somebody monitoring what a vehicle is doing. So it's possible that maybe you wouldn't have, you know, a driver in the seat, but you would have somebody monitoring from somewhere. You know, I'm not sure. I haven't seen the proposals yet for anything like that, but it is something that is being tracked. It is something being tracked. Absolutely. Thank you. Good question.
David Weaver?
Senator, my name is David Weaver. I'm from Woodbury County. My understanding, and I don't really verify this, but I just heard that the Trump administration has decided to The 10th Circuit made that decision maybe a month ago, agreed enough that they were going to enforce the law of the renewable fuel standard in small refineries. And I know that you and Senator Grassley both confirmed Mr. Weaver. He's making those decisions. They're impacting Iowa farmers.
Right.
And this decision, this appeal, on a 3-0 decision,
mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I've already spoken to the president today. This blindsided us, and it was our understanding, and it wasn't Andrew Wheeler that made this decision. Okay, so what happened, the way I understand it, is Ted Cruz went to the White House, and the details of this, I'm not sure what occurred, but somehow he ended up bending Attorney General Barr's ear on this, And the purpose of their visit was immigration. It wasn't supposed to be renewable fuels. So he ended up talking to Attorney General Barr and convincing him they needed to go back. When I talked to the president, of course, we had played phone tag last night. I was on a plane, he was on a plane. But I briefly spoke with him earlier today because I wanted to tell him this is a really bad idea. And he was on a helicopter going over the tornado damage down south. So we didn't get to talk long. He said he'd call me back later today. We could have a longer conversation. But he said they are getting pressure from folks like Ted Cruz, other representatives in those oil states, because they are afraid that the small refineries are going to shut down now. Well, we are afraid, and we know that those that are producing biofuels are ethanol producers. They already saw this last summer. So that's what we're communicating to the president. So what he said, just in that very short, very noisy conversation, was that they do plan to proceed with the appeal. And I've looked at the statistics, because we're working with the industries, believe me. We've been on the phone and back and forth. Over the last 24 hours. And it's only a fraction, a very, very small percentage of appeals that will actually be taken up and reconsidered. And out of those that are reconsidered, most of them will not be overturned. So the president, his point to me was, Joni, it's not going to be overturned. It's not going to be overturned. And this way, let Ted Cruz and the oil buddies, you know, feel good about what they're doing. But he said it's not going to be overturned. You know, the ethanol industry is still going to be staying strong. I have issue with it too. We'll have more of that conversation when he calls back later today. Right. Yeah, absolutely. And so I think they have until Monday to file. And so there are a number of us. I know Senator Grassley has been involved in a number of conversations as well. I spoke to him last night. I have a call in with Larry Kudlow as well. I'm trying to call anybody that we can. The president is the obvious one. But we'll continue pushing on the issue. If they go forward, we'll have to make sure we have our ducks in a row. Hope to God it's not overturned. The oil industry has been very, and they're not even sneaky about what they're trying to do. So I've always said this, and I'll always believe it. When we score a win, we still have to be vigilant, because they're always going to be lurking around, ready to throw something in the president's ear and mislead him. And I think that's what they've done, is mislead him, because we don't see small refineries closing. We don't see that. So their argument is very weak, which is why the Tenth Circuit 3-0 said no more SREs for these companies. We'll have more discussions over this. This is the hot topic of the day. And there will be more to follow. But now in this energy bill that's coming up next week that I referenced, there's a number of amendments that our oil state friends have put on there, like capping RIN prices and something with the small refinery exemptions as well. And so we're going to be blocking those. We'll do our darndest to keep all that kind of stuff out of the energy bill as well. The law is the law. They need to follow the law.
Greg Jacobson? Was it Jackson? Is it Jackson?
Jacobs.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for coming. I appreciate you being here. Mm-hmm. After 8 years of Benghazi investigation with really no indictments or anything that came out of it, the GOP appears to begin an investigation of the Bidens. Senator Romney said that it looks like it appears to be for political purposes. Do you agree with Senator Romney? And why or not? Why or not? why not?
Yeah, no, I don't agree with Senator Romney because these investigations over Burisma have been ongoing. They have not stopped, as far as I know from Ron Johnson. It's been, and he is the chair of Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs. And so this is not, oh, okay, now Biden's surging, so we're gonna go ahead and study this more. It's been an ongoing investigation, as far as I know, it has been. So there are always investigations that are done. I mean, we can look at, you know, any number of investigations spurred on by Democrats, by Republicans. We have just become quite the investigative body over in the House. And, you know, by and large, if everything is cool, then it'll be fine. And if not, then we'll see where that committee decides to go.
Lori?
Hi, Lori, go ahead.
I just had a question. I just was going to, it's a new one for me. But anyway, I just saw that there's been proposals by Democrats that just got introduced today to mandate paid sick leave. In lieu of like all the stuff that's going on now with Corona and flu and everything like that. Do you think you'll support this?
I'm not familiar with this one. It's, you said mandate paid sick leave?
Paid sick leave.
Mandated.
Yeah.
No, if it's private industry, I think private industry can decide what is best for their employees. I am a proponent of paid family leave, but that's when you're having a baby, adopting a new child. I don't dive into mandating sick leave. I don't know that would be appropriate for the federal government to tell a small business owner you're going to go bankrupt by forcing them to pay sick leave if it's not part of their policy. What's that? I mean, if you have ideas. Absolutely, and I think most people that are involved in those types of industries will make those wise decisions and understand that. So, but for the government to tell any of you, this is what you are going to do, I think there are certain things that can be done and certain things that can't be done, but there are differences between larger businesses that might be able to support those proposals and small business owners. You know, just visit any of the small businesses here in town and say, okay, the federal government says you're gonna have to pay wages for people going home when maybe they can't work from home. It would be very difficult. So I think the less government intervention we have and wise decisions made by business owners is a better way to go.
Tim Bardo.
Tim Bardo. I'm currently president of the House Senate Association. And first of all, I wanted to thank you for your leadership. And you've definitely been a champion for rural Iowa, renewable fuels, policy, trade, infrastructure. And especially want to thank you for securing funding for dredging the Lower Mississippi. That will definitely help not only basins but price in the upper Midwest and help us be more competitive with exports. My biggest concern is the same one David had on the RFS and the small refinery waivers. I guess, you know, this is something we've been fighting and I've been in your office and we've talked, you know, many times, and it's just like, when is it going to end? In 2018 at the State Fair, I was at a round table with, at that time, Acting Administrator Wheeler, and I asked him a question when he kept saying, you know, the small refinery waivers are law. And I said, it's also in the law on volumes. So why are you falling one side and not the other? And mine was the only question that he didn't answer, and he just went on to the next. So as a farmer and a representative of the soybean farmers in Iowa, what can we do to help the president understand the damage that has happened here? We went through the farm crisis in the 80s and lost a generation of farmers. David and I are some of the young farmers, and we're around 50. We can't afford to lose another generation of farmers that will really damage the industry. So what can we do?
Yeah, Tim, thank you. And I love it when people say 50 is young, so thanks. Yeah, we are in a really tough situation, folks. And I've said this before, Tim, but I don't think we will ever be at a point where we can rest on our laurels. That's not going to happen. In my estimation, and what we have been able to achieve so far is, you know, doing E15 year round and, you know, getting the administration to tell us that we're doing, you know, the gallon requirements by law. To just get to that point, it's felt like some pretty major victories. And, you know, that's the law. Just getting them to follow the law is like a major victory. But I've always felt that once we get over one hurdle, the oil industry is always going to throw up another hurdle. And the oil industry has been so good about promulgating myths across the United States. What we have run into, and you just have to understand, there are a lot fewer of us from these biofuel producing states that support the renewable fuel standard than there are of everybody else. So you've maybe got two-thirds of the Congress and Senate working against us. You know, those that don't come from rural areas. You know, everybody has ag in their states, but they don't have ag like Iowa does, like South Dakota does, like Nebraska does. You know, we're fighting an uphill battle, I think. We've been successful, and we're going to continue fighting. The problem is we have so many others that are fighting against us. That's why we have to have a strong, unified voice. And that's what we've had, thank God. And we make headway because we do have a strong, unified voice. What we have to do is unwind some of the myths that exist out there that have been pushed out by the oil industry. So it was probably 6 months ago, I was visiting, we had some visitors that were coming through the Hart building, and just in an off-site conversation, and this guy was from, I don't even remember what state he was from, but it wasn't an ag state like us, and he knows that I'm really strong on the RFS, and he said, I don't agree with you on the RFS. He's like, you're taking all of that food away from people. And I had to explain to him that, one, what we're producing here is not consumable by the public. It goes into livestock feed, and it goes into producing biofuels. But I further explained to him that with the biofuels, you have those DDGs and other products that come out that then can be converted into livestock feed. I said, there is no waste. All of it's used. And he's like, well, I didn't know that. You know, and it did change his mind, but he's been living so many years with all these silly little things that have been pushed out there by those in the oil industry. And I even have folks that really don't have a dog in the fight. You know, folks in, they're not oil-producing states, and they're not biofuel-producing states, but they tend to side with the oil industry because of all the myths that have been pushed out there. And it just is taking us a really long time to educate all these folks on what is right and what is wrong. So we're going to continue fighting as hard as we can, Tim. We know how important it is. I believe that we do better. We're a smaller carbon footprint than the oil industry. You know, and you'd think even some of our green friends would want to jump on board, but they're even half-hearted cheerleaders. So we've just got to figure out the path forward and keep up a good fight and do it with a unified voice. And that's what we've been able to do over the course of the last several years. So thanks, Tim, very much.
Kent Sheed.
I'm a really big fan of the Affordable Care Act. I think it's the best piece of legislation since Medicare in 1965. And I just like to, I hope that means something to you. The latest poll shows 55% of the American people really want to keep it, and 37% are still listening to Fox News. And if you break it down into its components, those favorable numbers go up. I'd like to just briefly speak about four of those aspects. Number one, we all have learned how important it is to get rid of pre-existing conditions. Today, it's true freedom for the American people to go get the job you want, work where you want, because you can get insurance. I have a son who lives in Phoenix. If he wants to come home and farm with me, he can do that today. Before the Affordable Care Act, if he had diabetes, a bad back, a heart condition, on and on and on, couldn't get insurance. He couldn't come home and farm with dad. So I think the freedom is incredible. Number two, everybody seems to really like the fact that you can keep your kid on your insurance till you're 26 years old. Number three, there's a tax above $250,000 that came with the Affordable Care Act to pay for some of these provisions. And it only if you make more, a couple makes more than $250,000, I'm assuming that doesn't affect too many people in this room, that tax is 0.9% on earned income. I hope you're, and you're probably aware of this, 3.8% on unearned income. And that tax in 2018 and maybe last year brought in $37 billion worth of B to help extend the life of Medicare. Fourth and finally, if you have an ACA, an Obamacare qualified insurance plan, which if you're working for somebody, you most likely you do, or I think maybe you absolutely do. And part of that plan is you're allowed to have a colonoscopy and a mammogram at no cost. It's preventive care. Before the Affordable Care Act, most people didn't do that, or a lot of people didn't, because you had to pay for it yourself. I farm, I had to pay for it myself. And so those things would cost maybe $3,000 for a colonoscopy and so forth. Well, our Iowa common sense tells us that provision alone has saved thousands upon thousands of Americans, maybe somebody in this room. And the actuaries told us that it was a no-brainer because, yeah, there's a lot of cost to providing colonoscopies and mammograms, but that was offset by the reduced cost of cancer care because cancer care is so expensive. So they said it was a wash cost-wise. Extremely important, saved thousands of American lives. We have 48 United States Democratic senators and three Republicans, Snow, Mikowski, and the famous thumbs down by John McCain at 1 o'clock in the morning that saved all those provisions for the people in this room, saved a lot of lives all across this country. You didn't think those provisions were important. Could you explain, at least to me, why
now
you don't think they're important?
There are a number of, and don't put words in my mouth.
Okay.
You voted against it, right? Yes, I did, but I did support many measures which would have kept pre-existing conditions, preventative maintenance. See, now you had your turn. So being able to support those things, pre-existing conditions, we absolutely must protect. I have not heard not a single senator say we shouldn't preserve protections for pre-existing conditions. As I stated earlier, I do have siblings that are type 1 diabetics. They rely on that care, and I would never want to see them shut out of opportunity for insurance. I also have a nephew with autism. It's important to me, it's important to my family. I don't know of any family that doesn't have someone that's not impacted by pre-existing conditions. So that is important. It's important to know that I supported the Collins bill, which I was a co-sponsor on, that would protect people with pre-existing conditions, or those that had illnesses which would take them above any sort of insurance cap. The state of Maine had this type of program. It was outlawed by Obamacare, but it worked, and they loved that system in Maine. So Susan was trying to reintroduce it to get it nationwide, and I supported her on those efforts. So there are a number of things that we can do, but what Obamacare did was provide access to insurance, correct?
Partly, 20 million people went on Medicaid and saved a lot of lives.
So we have a lot of folks that are covered now.
Yes.
But what it did not do was control the cost of health care.
It saved
and that's what we are trying to do now by working with finding information from hospitals and clinics. You know, what are the costs that can be controlled? What are the areas where we can do cost savings for those consumers? Prescription drugs. When I ask folks, outside of the cost of your health insurance premiums, which are sky high for a lot of folks, if outside of that cost, what's the number one cost that you have? That's prescription drugs. Obamacare didn't control that cost to the consumer, so we're tackling that now, right? So we're working on a number of different issues. We understand that if you have an insurance plan that you like, we want you to keep it. That didn't necessarily happen with Obamacare. We've still seen rates go up. A family of three in Red Oak, Iowa, that I know personally, small business owners, $28,000 a year in premiums for health insurance. They make too much to get government subsidy.
That's not because of the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act.
It wasn't Senator, like that before the Affordable Care Act.
Oh, yes, it was. I know farmers are.
So, well,
Senator,
it wasn't.
Could you explain to me where we would be today if your vote was successful? We wouldn't have any of the provisions I talked about.
Yes, you would. If we had been able to pass, like, the Susan Collins bill, we had a Lamar Murray bill also that would have covered down on a lot, and they were bipartisan pieces.
All the bills that I saw that covered pre-existing conditions, which they did not put a restriction on the premium the insurance companies could pay, and it was going to be prohibitive to pay for. What we know now is that what we have works. What we have works. Let's just try to build on it.
Great. Now, there are a lot of things that we can correct on. Right? Law can be corrected. But the Susan Collins bill did control costs.
I agree with you.
You pay the same thing as everybody else. When you buy a plan, you pay the same price.
You're right. When there's a big piece of legislation, there's a lot of things to fix, but we're not trying to fix them. We're trying to throw the baby out.
A lot of things that
we're trying to throw the baby out with the bathwater instead of fix.
And we can argue about it all day, but I can also share, you know, the people that called in very concerned about it, folks that were undergoing cancer treatment when Obamacare went into play, those oncologists would have to call in to get approval on certain treatments, and we'd be denied that when they knew the best treatment was XYZ, and the folks administering Obamacare said, you can't offer that treatment. It doesn't fit into this manual here. So there's not as much freedom out there in treatment possibilities. Can we improve? Certainly we can improve. What we're trying to do is focus on healthcare costs because it's bipartisan. We can get it done. We can hopefully get it through the Senate, get it through the House, and get it to the President. That's what we're working on.
Remember the applause. Thank you.
Mike Hogan?
Thanks, Senator.
Yeah,
first of all, I have a little commentary. So, for the last 12 years, I've become very, very frustrated that it seems like Democrats now work for the Democratic Party, Republicans serve the Republican Party, and you've forgotten that you represent us. Mm-hmm. And collectively, you represent our country. And I think it's way past time that we put down the partisanship and start working together. Let's end my commentary. You said roughly a month ago to make some comments about the Biden and the brief. Earlier this week, you made a comment about the socialistic ideology of Bernie Sanders. And then we went through the impeachment trial of President Trump for corrupt behavior, whatever you may want to call it. And one of the reasons we were concerned about it all came about was that holding up aid to Ukraine because we were concerned about corruption in a new forming government. Yet, I don't recall anyone having any problems the 2 years prior to that when it was a known corrupt country holding up any aid. So how do we balance those? I mean, where are we coming from, and what can we do to get back to this
representing all of us instead of our party.
Right. So a lot going on in that comment. But yes, I do believe Bernie Sanders is socialist because he says he's socialist. Just the truth of the matter. But yes, and I think there's a lot that the media will lead you to believe, and the only things that they will focus on are the things that divide us rather than the things that unify us. Most of the bills that I will offer in the United States Senate, and you can go onto my website, ernst.senate.gov, and go through my list of bills. Most of my bills are bipartisan. I always strive to find a Democrat that shares those same values and ideas that I do. I think that is very important. And one, it's not going to pass in the Senate unless you have bipartisan support. So instead of focusing on all of the wonderful issues that we're able to get accomplished, the media is going to focus on the things where we have the greatest areas of disagreement. How many of you had heard before today, and I said it a little bit ago, that the Environment Public Works Transportation Bill passed out unanimously? That is one of the largest, most significant packages that we will pass this year. And yet we all did it together, unanimously. But who reported on it? Nobody. It is a package that will affect every American. And none of the media thought it was a big enough deal to report on. Why? Because we weren't fighting over it. So bipartisanship is not dead in the United States Senate. And I can't speak for the House, but I would say, it's not dead in the House either. So there are a lot of really great things that we're working on together, going back to prescription drugs. Maybe some people disagree. How many think we shouldn't be working on prescription drugs? Okay, yeah, it's bipartisan. I think we've got a great mixed group here. It's bipartisan. And, the eyebrows that go up when you talk about Ron Wyden and Chuck Grassley working together. You couldn't have two more difficult people, and yet they're working together to find a solution for prescription drug costs. So I think that there are a lot of really great things that go on. Just nobody talks about it. And we try to be vocal about the things that we do agree on. And even during the impeachment, as politically heated as that was, when we walk off the floor of the Senate, I was still friends with Kirsten Gillibrand. I was still, speaking to other people. So I don't think there was any animosity between anybody. Even while that was going on, we all maintained our friendships. So, I just think we have to open our eyes a little bit, take a deep breath, understand that there are very heated issues that impact our daily lives, and the best solution is working together on a bipartisan solution and find that way forward. That's the only way that we will get things done in Congress right now, and certainly I agree there needs to be a lot more of it. Mm-hmm.
First of all, to Tim's deal on what can we do as farmers, we need to tell our story.
Yeah.
We have to advocate. I know it's a grossly abused word, but if we don't tell our story, then you can't tell our story.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's sidebar to that.
No,
but
that's
I guess, to me, though, the part of the frustration I had was, and I guess it was like mud, so I apologize. You commented on the socialistic and that, and then, when we needed to hear more information, whether you vote for the witnesses or the documentation to be released, I don't think it probably would have changed the outcomes, but wasn't it important that all that information get released?
Okay, I see where you are.
Where was your voice?
Going that's fine, I get it now. Going back to the impeachment trial, the point was some of the votes there. And we actually submitted everything. The whole House record was submitted into the Senate record. All of the documents, 26,000 pages of documents we had. The 17 witnesses that were called, we heard from testimony from 13 of them. So we didn't call new witnesses. That's not the job of the Senate. The House is the investigative body. They are to investigate and do the impeachment process. Their record is to be turned over to the Senate. The Senate will take up that record, we will examine that record, and then we will listen to the prosecution on that record and make a determination. That's exactly what we did. So as far as calling new witnesses, we didn't need to call new witnesses. Like the John Bolton thing, the House had long decided that they didn't even call him. They decided it wasn't worth calling him. So they didn't bother going through the procedures. They said, well, it's going to take too long, so we're not going to worry about him. They thought that they had enough information, but what they presented, you know, it wasn't a convincing argument. So, yeah, very quickly,
yeah,
we've
got
some other stuff.
But my point still is that the reason they didn't investigate it was that President Trump and Barr had said, we're going to block it. So where does that oversight
right.
come from?
But what happens then is then they will go through the court system, which is the proper procedure. That's what happened in previous impeachments. They had to go through the court system, and then the court would issue those subpoenas and say, you must testify. But they decided, we don't want to go through that process. It's going to take too long. The election is coming up. We need to have this done before the election. So it was very political from the beginning. On both sides, sure. Sure.
Thanks
it was a political exercise.
Thanks for your patience.
So, yeah, no, absolutely. But it was very much a political exercise. And unfortunately, it delayed things like USMCA, the transportation bill that we had been working on in the Senate, wasn't taken up over in the House because of, you know, whatever they were doing over there. More bipartisanship. How about that?
Last question. Jesse Green.
Senator, thank you for your service.
You betcha.
I'm running for the Senate district here in 24. My question for you is, just the other day I read somewhere where we have over $20 billion in oil subsidies, and I don't know if that was a real number or not. It sounded really big, but if that's true, what is all that going for?
Yeah, I don't know that is. I would have to go back and do some research on that, because I do know that the oil industry through the years has been given, I don't know that whether they were subsidies, but they were given certain provisions, maybe easing of various regulations or whatever it was through all the years that may add up to something like that. I would have to go back and do a fact check on that. But while we're on that subsidy issue, I can't tell you one of the other myths that's out there. I have so many folks that will come out and say, well, what about all the tax subsidies for ethanol? And I have to explain them. There are no tax subsidies for ethanol. They're like, well, what about all those tax breaks they get? And there is no such thing. But they're all under some sort of assumption that the federal government subsidizes ethanol, and we don't. There's no subsidy for ethanol. So again, it's going back and telling our story as the American farmer and as the biofuels producers that this is our story, this is why we're important, and we need to be part of the fabric of our energy resources. So let me do some research on that. That'd be a really great talking point if I can nail that down. Yeah, thank you. Well, I appreciate everybody coming out today and spending some time with me. A lot of really great questions. A lot of you are probably like, what's she writing down up there? I'm not drawing doodles or anything like that. I'm actually writing down your names and then the questions that you asked or the points that you made. I actually do take those back. My staff will enter these into our system. And that way, if we need to go back, follow up with anyone, or if we have any additional questions, maybe on a point you were making or information maybe you asked that, you know, we need to follow up on, we can go back and do that. I do use some of the stories that I hear as I'm out doing town halls, because the stories are very important. When I go back to Washington, D.C., if we're talking about biofuels, I can use some of the information that I'm pulling from my town halls to try and convince maybe a senator from Arkansas or somewhere else that really doesn't have any skin in the game try and convince them that we're doing the right thing. So again, I want to thank everybody for being here today and sharing your thoughts with me. It is really important. Again, this was stop number 13 of the year. It was my second town hall. We completed 35 town halls last year, and we'll continue doing that. I want to make sure that I'm remaining accessible to all of you and hearing all these different points of view. So thanks for coming out today. I really do appreciate it. Have a great afternoon.
Take care, Cooper.